I mean, just don't trust them.
Yeah.
Because they're rich. Don't trust rich people. And dissociate your fandom of them from them. Do not make any assumptions about rich people. And you know what? That's exactly why listeners of the Spectator Film Podcast should make no assumptions that we are good people. Just because we're rich and you love our show
We make so much money off of the show. I don't think we talk about that nearly enough on this.
Yeah, we don't talk about the money we make. We make so much.
We are the youngest quadrillionaires in history.
Yeah. We're so rich that it hasn't registered with people how rich we are yet because they haven't finished counting our fucking money.
It literally broke the bank. They're just like, listen, dude, you're not going to have access to any of this until we invent numbers for how much money you have from your fucking podcast.
Yeah.
It's honestly astonishing, and we have to thank you all for giving us all your money. But
yeah. And this is what you get in return.
Nothing.
Nothing. Yeah. Welcome to the Spectator Film Podcast. It's a podcast about nothing. But that's not true. What we're really talking about today, that was an interesting intro. It's fun to pretend to be rich, though, isn't it?
Not really. But the title of the film we're doing today is something a rich person might say to one of their many servants.
Whistle and I'll come to you. Yes. Well, that's part of this movie, I think, Max. You're making a joke, but I think class does play into this movie a little bit. By the way, I'm Austin.
And I'm Max.
And like you said, we're doing the movie Whistle and I'll Come to You. We might want to specify, not the 2010 version.
Yes, I made that mistake.
Which Max watched accidentally in preparation for this episode. Max, do you have any, before we even begin talking about this one, do you have any, opinions or thoughts you'd like to share? Let's get in a little mini review of this 2010 movie.
Okay. Can I do it in, two sentences? Because I don't...
Let's do it in four.
Okay.
Give it a little bit more respect.
I understand what the BBC was trying to do. They were riding high on Doctor Who and Sherlock and wanted to update some of the old good stuff that they had done.
Is it a TV show?
No, it was a...
Okay.
It was done in a similar style.
Oh, callback to another famous thing they'd done. Yeah.
But I'm saying that they had a history of doing that at that point with Sherlock and Doctor Who.
Yeah, sure. Makes sense.
Let's try to reboot our...
Yearly Christmas horror movie. Yeah.
And John Hurt's performance, A+, 10 out of 10. John Hurt always gives all of his effort in whatever he's doing, and he really tried for that. The rest of the short movie is garbage.
Is it a short as well?
It is a short as well, which made it bearable to watch. It's slightly longer than the original. And it's trying too much to update to modern horror, and because of that, it loses any sort of charm the original has, and it's boring and stupid because of that.
Yeah.
It literally ends with a ghost ? Of his wife yelling, "I'm still here," and a jump scare. And it's dumb and stupid and not worth watching.
And also, you said it doesn't even have a whistle in it.
No, it doesn't. There's no whistling. I didn't even think about that until the end. After I watched it, I'm like, why the fuck is this called that? Austin's like, no, I meant the original version. I'm like, oh, there's an original version. That makes a lot more sense.
Well, to be fair, I don't know if this is even the original adaptation of it. This is merely the most well-known one. And even that being said, I don't think it's incredibly well-known. I mean, it's a TV movie from the 60s. At least here in the U.S., I don't think it's very well-known. Maybe more so in the U.K. Because they have that sort of more... I don't know, straightforward tradition of how TV works there with the BBC and everything. However, I'm glad we're not talking about the 2010 version. That's all I can really say. Also, didn't they do a thing where by introducing his wife, they make it so he's mourning and stuff like
it's
that? Not,
it's like, it's a weird thing of just like his wife had dementia and it's just like all this stuff. They try to layer on so much shit.
And here's the thing. I think you can dig into this version, the 1968 version. And you can find potential implications about, did he have a wife? Does he himself have dementia? Et cetera, et cetera. You can find all that in here if you want to. It's just not on the nose about it.
Is he?
It's just very patient, you know?
Is he slowly
deteriorating
yeah. as many men do after their wives die?
Yeah. And it just doesn't have to bring up any of that because it just leaves it up to the performance. It's amazing. I watched this movie for the first time, I want to say in January of this year. And then I immediately watched another one of the adaptations of an M.R. James ghost story that they made for the BBC a few years later called The Ash Tree. And that one is also like fucking weird and interesting. And after that, I stopped watching any of them because I'm like, I'm saving them for Halloween. And I am so excited to finally continue watching them. Both of them were great. And my impression of the rest of them is that they're also really great. So this is a part of a series of Christmas horror movies that were made by the BBC around this time period. This was the first big one. And then they returned and they made a bunch of other M.R. James ones. And then they made a few Dickens ones.
It's very British in its tradition of...
Very British.
To make sure that you're not enjoying yourself at any point during the holiday season.
No, of course not. Why would you... Here's the real thing. Why would you spare Christmas from ghost stories? Absolutely not. Even the best ghost story ever, perhaps, The Turn of the Screw, has a framing device where they're talking about sharing ghost stories over a Christmas fire. So Christmas and ghost stories go together very well. And we're recording this for Halloween Spooktober. You can also do this as a Christmas type movie too.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring ting tingling too.
That's right, Max. That's a Christmas song. Come on, good job.
That's lovely.
You did it. But yeah, so I watched it for the first time this year. It's my pick. And I just thought it was great. I thought this movie, although it is only 40 minutes, is exemplary in its patience. This is such a patient movie. And I love its level of restraint. It's almost in some ways like the English ghost story par excellence in film. Because it's like, it just refuses to, be explicit about a lot of stuff until the very end. And it just is very elegant and graceful and, dare I say, even a little bit poetic
and
in its restraint.
Even if you could call the end explicit, it's really not.
Yeah.
And I guess I should get into my incredibly limited experience with
this. You watched it for the first time yesterday.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have a very long and sordid history with this
movie. But you know what? You have an experience with this that I don't have. You watched the remake first, so I don't even know what that's
like.
Yes,
so I found this more enjoyable, which is...
That's good to hear.
It's always nice when... I've only done this a couple of times, because normally I do my due diligent research and find out a movie's a remake and go watch the original before I watch the remake of it, so I have context. Most of the time I do find out the original is better, because...
It's just the way it goes sometimes, yeah.
But this was, like, an immediate of, like... Oh, I watched the wrong one for prep. Okay, let's do this now. Because honestly, I was about to spend an entire episode calling Austin's film taste out for like, what the fuck, dude? Why do you like this?
Well, I remember we were talking on the phone yesterday and you're like, I really did not get this. Yeah. And you're like, there's John Hurt and it's just kind of like, eh. But what did you like about this one? What stuck out to you?
The cinematography, despite being relatively simple, is incredibly well done. Yeah. It builds tension and just sets the mood very, very well. I'm not going to say the acting is superb, but it gets across exactly what it needs to for this type of short film.
I would, though. I would say it's superb.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're entitled to. And... I just think, it's a simple ghost story, and you kind of need those during Halloween, and I guess during Christmas, too. But
yeah, Christmas even more so, perhaps, because you can't let everyone have a good time without getting back at them. So, so this movie is really great, and it's only 40 minutes long, people, and a lot of these other ones are also shorts, so you can just bang these out. These are great. Instead of watching another dumb episode of a stupid prestige TV show, put this on, because you're going to enjoy this way more.
What prestige TV show is there anymore? They're all dead now.
Every TV show is prestige TV. That's the thing. It means nothing.
I don't know. Until the Game of Thrones prequel.
Succession. There you go. That was a recent one.
Game of Thrones preschool edition or whatever.
Game of Thrones preschool. That would be great. Instead of doing remakes, you just do a remake where it's like...
Just do it how they did like late 90s, early 2000.
Yeah, preschool kids act out the same plot.
Why not? It would probably be a better ending than Game of Thrones.
And they only have a month to prepare.
Sure.
So you have like the teachers being like, okay, students, gather around. And they're all in their outfits. That'd be great. I'd love that. But yeah, so, but anyway, yeah, so this movie's very short. You can sit down, you could just hammer it out. And here's the thing, despite the 2010 version being not so good, I would love to see, you know, TV studios try to do little TV specials like this once again for the holidays. It'd be great. I love that. Just a, you know, 40-minute short movie they release on Christmas. That'd be great. So maybe we'll do more of these in the future, too. But this one is definitely, as far as I know, one of the best in that group. So are you ready to begin, Max?
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring-ting-tingling, too.
This is a weird thing for you to keep.
Come on, it's lovely weather for whistle, and I'll come to you.
Whoa! Whoa, ooh, what a rhyme. Oh, my God. Omnibus. Omnibus was a company that previously before this had produced mostly prestige documentaries in the UK. And this was one of their first big forays into making something that was fiction. Pretty good first attempt, I'd say.
I would say too, but like, this is such a wonderful blend of like stereotypical, almost like jokey art house cinema at this point. Like the flat shot on the beach as somebody walks is like, it's like a joke you would make as a film student now, but like in the time, this is a great shot. And like at the same time, we just have this dry English narration of just like, this is a tale of the terrible supernatural and a man who experienced this thing. And there's a tale of terror and morals. And it's I love the dry narration on this flat shot on this beach. It just sets the tone for the movie wonderfully.
Well, it gives it that storybook vibe.
Yes.
You're talking about the beach. It's like it's a great, easy sort of abstract space. And you see the character walking in from the distance in the beach. And it's just it's a nice way to begin your story.
But also it's like this flat, cloudy beach that I'm just like, oh, that's England. Okay.
Yeah, it really does look and feel and communicate a vibe of like Norfolk, of where this takes place. But here we go. We set up the sheets at the very beginning, which you won't realize is important until the end, because it's those same sheets that will drive him mad in the end. And already we're going to see something interesting here in the first opening sequence. We're going to see maids. One thing we mentioned in the introduction is about how this does relate to ideas of class, this movie. And I do not know if that's in the original story because I have not read it.
Neither have I.
However, I can tell you that clearly there's a certain class implication about this sort of professor character's interactions with everyone around them. And it begins with the maids making up the bed that, again, will be the sheets that comprise the monster that scares him later. Oh, by the way, I should mention, we're watching this on YouTube. I don't know if you can find these streaming officially anywhere else, or even if they've ever been released on home video.
Yeah.
At least in the US, I don't think.
Funnily enough, I found the more recent John Hurt one on YouTube as well. Like,
huh, okay.
So, yeah, I don't know. I know the BBC uploads a good portion of their programming to YouTube, but not usually in its entirety. Normally just like clips to get you interested, but.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, it's a pretty good quality for YouTube still. So, you know, it's not bad. We're watching this on a big TV, and if we were usually watching something on YouTube, it might be a little bit more pixelated than it is.
Yeah, it'd be grainy, pixelated.
That said, I would like to see an update of this, because I bet the blacks and the whites really do. The contrast just works a little bit better if you were to sort of remaster this for a new digital edition.
Oh, Austin, by the way, you've forgotten to inform the audience that we're doing something fun during this one.
We're doing a drinking game. You're welcome to join us, listeners. And what we're doing is, we have a bottle of J&B, as is tradition for Halloween, and we are going to take a drink every time there's British grumbling. There's lots of grumbling in this.
Every time you're going to hear jowls just slapping against the face, you take a drink.
Yes, our main character is the main offender here, although the proprietor of the hotel also grumbles quite a bit.
Yes.
Here's the question, though.
So if we pass out, if this podcast is like 8 hours long,
I think we're going to go insane by the end.
Yeah, just so you know, we drank ourselves into a coma and forgot to stop recording.
I'll edit it out. I'll edit all that out.
No, the ghost is the one who's going to post it.
Oh, God. You're right.
the editing. Ghost that does all of our editing.
Yeah.
We don't know
who we pay and provide healthcare for.
Yes, of course. He's union.
Yes. A union ghost. Oh my God. Can you imagine if ghosting was a job?
Do you think he has to pay union booze?
Oh, union booze. How many hours of haunting do you need to get into the union? That's the real question. If you're a ghost, let us know. Spectator
please like, comment, subscribe. Yeah.
Rate our show, please, on iTunes. So yes, here's the proprietor of the hotel. I love the way they introduce him at the end of the hallway, and he just walks over slowly.
I think that's our first drink.
Yeah, that's our first one. Here we go.
Prost.
Okay, perfect. J&B doesn't taste good, though.
Why did I let you talk me into this, Jesus?
Because you're dumb.
I know.
You're dumb for even doing this podcast. It's too late for you, so you might as well do more dumb things. So anyway, in these first few scenes, we're going to notice an interesting pattern forming already around our main character's behavior. And that specifically relates to how he sort of interacts with the working people around him. The first thing we see are the maids preparing his sheets. Then we see his driver, who he very awkwardly provides a tip to. Something about the way he gives him his tip, like, rings with authenticity to me of, like, you know, a grumpy old man. And then he walks in through the door. He lets himself in after knocking. And then he insists that the proprietor bring his bags up to his room. So he's this weird, socially oblivious behavior mixed with like a sense of entitlement. And these are all things that are going to come back to bite him in the ass.
Fundamentally British.
But asshole British.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, not to insult any listeners we might have in the UK, but I mean, if you're in the UK, there's a majority chance that you hate the British too.
That's fair. Yeah.
But still, like, yeah, I don't know.
There's more grumbling here, by the way.
Yeah. Okay. God damn.
We're going again.
I'm gonna pass out.
I mean, the proprietary, he looks over this room and he's like, dinner, you know, dinner's at 8.
Yes.
So, I think there's an interesting pattern here with how he relates to these workers. He acts very entitled, and he does not, in most ways, try to directly engage with the means of doing his own work. Right? He doesn't want to bring his bags up the stairs. He doesn't drive himself. He doesn't make his own bed, as we see later. And, it's all very interesting to me because I think that grounds the emotional reality of this character as a character who's very lonely, as a character who can't help but drive people around him crazy, I would assume. It grounds it in a political truth about an older group of British citizens at this time. And you can say that, you know, oh, you're reading too much into it. The movie, I think, allows for that, though. And do remember, this came out in 1968.
Yes.
Maybe the climax of like political unease in
well, that was also
the Western world in the 20th century. Well, maybe not the 20th century. Second half of the 20th century.
Well, that is when the Labour Party had started to gain traction and monarchists had started to get back into the popular discussion in UK politics.
Sure. So. I mean, 68 was a crazy year.
Yeah.
For any number of reasons.
So
having a
what I was going with that was saying like an awareness of like the old classist British ideology would have been in the air at the time. So
absolutely.
I don't think you're reading too much into it is what I was saying.
No, of course. And I mean, what you're talking about too, relating this to an older Britain, I mean, that's part of the thing with this character too, is that he's old. And definitely people can read into this and look at his behavior, the acting, the performance, and you can say that potentially, oh, it's just him succumbing to some sort of mental deterioration that comes with age, whether it's dementia or something else. Of course, that doesn't excuse the political sort of fable hidden here, is that this generation is behaving in ways that are fundamentally antisocial, reinforce a type of like exploitation, and cut off any sort of like genuine connection. I mean, there, it doesn't really suggest a lot about it, but there's a reason why he's here alone, you know?
Yeah, I kept getting like, the movie never really pushed this too far for me, but I thought it was going to be like almost a Shutter Island type thing.
Oh, where he was crazy the whole time?
Not even crazy, but like he got like put in a retirement home
or something. Oh, and they're bringing him back and he thinks it's like,
I'm on vacation in this nice place.
Yes.
And it kind of does have vibes of that, of just like this old man of just like, oh, I'm upper crust, I'm staying at this nice resort. And then just like, he's by himself and alone and people are tending to him. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. I do think this shot is very interesting, though, with him in the foreground and this woman who keeps making eyes at him in the sort of mid-ground. This is the closest the movie comes to really commenting on sex in any way. But I think it's interesting, again, when you realize that he's going on this vacation by himself, right? He's an older man. He clearly is very alone in his life. He doesn't have a lot of people. And you have this implication of this sort of vaguely sexual connection, because now clearly they didn't make any conversation and this woman is going to walk by him with another man, another lucky man with a walrus mustache. They're going to fuck tonight, aren't they? Yes, they are. But not our lead. No.
Do British people fuck? I didn't know that about them. I thought they just shook hands very firmly and
then came. It's like Barbarella, kind of. No, they just make contact with each other's hands.
They just shook hands firmly, and then 9 months later, a baby formed out of nowhere.
And then the queen nodded, and...
Yes, the queen anointed them a baby.
Yes. But that's...
To any of our UK listeners, why the fuck do you still have a queen? Explain this to me. Tell me what purpose she serves in the comments below.
Why do we still have... an electoral college.
Because we're stupid. At least we admit that.
They're also stupid.
I know, but the English... the Brits at least hold themselves with like a... oh, we're smarter than the Americans attitude.
Fuck you. You're smarter than no one.
Boris Johnson is your prime minister. Come on there.
But anyway... oh, here's another moment of labor where they make his bath for him. So he won't even start his own bath. I don't know if that's how Inns works there, but it is peculiar to me how much this movie focuses and emphasizes the fact of her actually making the bath for him. So he doesn't do any of the work. But the point I wanted to finish making is I think there's an interesting thing going on in this movie with the two beds and one of the beds being seemingly occupied by the ghost before it then possesses the sheets itself, right? And the idea of the unoccupied bed also being like the emptiness of his life.
I was going to say, the unoccupied bed for me struck out as just like a cruel reminder of his loneliness.
Yeah.
Of just like, he walks into the room that he's reserved for himself and there's two beds there of just like, you fucking loser. There should have been two people in this room. How, like, you really? It's just you? Come on, man.
Yeah. And I think the political reality at play here is that this class of person prefers to engage people in a way where it's like, oh, we miss more grumbling, by the way, when he goes to the bath.
This scene in general is going to fucking kill us.
There's not so much grumbling in this.
When he starts waxing philosophically later on, there is.
I would say after he makes his comment about there's more in philosophy than in heaven and earth, and he makes that like very, very self-satisfied, like, interior laughter that
golfing. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that's some real grumbling. The food though is just, that's just the way British people eat. We're coming for you British people today. I'm sorry.
I still can't believe there's no little egg in the cup. Like that's the most quintessential you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like the little stand and there's an egg and you hit
it. I always thought that looked so good when I was a kid. And then I realized that British food is not good. Well, can someone explain stargazy pie to me? Why? Why'd you do that?
What was like a food object in a movie that like looked great and then like you had it in real life? I know
it's impossible because it's cartoons, but I always thought those bugs they eat in The Emperor's New Groove.
Yeah.
I'm like, I fucking eat those bugs.
There was
John Goodman's like, let me pop that one for you.
What was it where it's like was it The Rescuers, or it was some movie with the mice. It was like creme de la creme, where they just dipped like a Ritz cracker into milk. And like they made it look like the greatest fucking thing ever. And I tried that when I was little. I'm like, this is fucking nasty. These mice were stupid.
I will say the other big food memory I had of movies as a kid was watching that. Which one is it?
Oh, you
Godzilla's
know what?
Revenge.
Oh, I have something equally stupid.
Where he has like, it honestly would be amazing tasting, where he's eating out of this giant like stew thing they made. And I always thought that looked like the most delicious thing ever.
I remember tree stars from the Land Before Time.
You wanted to eat those?
I was fucking 4 years old, dude. They looked delicious at the time.
Who? What 4 year old would watch that movie and not want to be one of the dinosaurs, but instead fixate on eating the tree star?
I wanted to do both.
Okay, that's fair.
Come on, man.
As long as you didn't want to do that instead of being the dinosaur.
No, of course I wanted to be a dinosaur. What kid didn't want to be? I was expecting this to be like his wife's grave or whatever, but yet again, my view is tainted by the sequel.
I know, you can read into this one that he has that unspoken wife. It all depends on how the performance hits you. You know, they leave a lot of the exposition in this movie. It's not exposition, but it's just things that you could recognize in his performance.
He does seem to be looking for somebody. He seems like that's the vibe I get off.
Yeah.
Like he almost seems like constantly to be like turning and just be like, waiting, like expecting somebody to be there to like share his thoughts with, and nobody's there.
Yeah.
He seems like he's used to having somebody to talk to and they're not there anymore. So he's went on a vacation desperately in an attempt to be like,
oh, he just grumbled, by the way, going over that grave. Sorry.
You're going to kill me like fucking Kurt Russell killed that chest wizard with J&B.
Is there any other movie where something was destroyed with J&B? Oh, here he's going to find the whistle. Now, we both had this initial response because there's bones there. He doesn't grab the bone. He just grabs the whistle. And I think when we were watching it for this first week, we saw this and we talked ourselves into saying like he grabbed a bone and then turned it into a whistle, which was like impressive craftsmanship, first of all. But also like, that's fucking gross. But no, he just grabbed the whistle. And then he gets followed immediately for the probably the most famous shot of the movie is the one coming up. And it is very beautiful. I wonder how they got it with this shot. That surely is not the sun. They probably just put a giant reflector down to get that. Because if that was the sun, I don't think it would expose so well.
I don't know. Black and white exposure is different than color exposure.
I just don't think it like matches the sky. But it looks beautiful. It looks incredible.
You don't know. They could have filmed on the one not cloudy day in England.
Maybe, who knows?
They waited the entire year for that shot.
I will say this. If you're a filmmaker, a student filmmaker, trying to make a movie with a lot of atmosphere and no budget, this movie is how you do it. They do a lot of great stuff with like staging in depth. And they're not afraid to use a wide angle lens and just put some things closer to the camera. You know, they're not afraid of things just being bigger. And like you were saying earlier, maybe it does feel a little film student-y at times,
well,
but I appreciate that.
It's basic at this point. Like, this movie's 60 years old now. Like, techniques that were new and interesting and stuff back then are commonplace now.
Sure.
So, like, when I say film student-y, I'm not trying to be dismissive. I'm saying that they're common now. And if you're trying to make an expressive film, it's something somebody would go to now. That doesn't mean that the movie's simple. It doesn't mean that, like, I'm dinging it for a lack of creativity.
It's just a description.
Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the thing I would say about that, is that I feel like very few movies rely solely on that simple camera vocabulary, you know? And that's why this movie impresses me so much, is because it has this sense of confidence and patience, where it's like, it's not going to try anything else other than that. It's just like, we're just doing this.
I think we need to do another thing at J&B.
Oh, yeah, he's 101 things a boy can do. Who knows what the fuck he's talking about? He's doing the thing where he traces the saying on the back of it, which I think is some Latin that I did not bother to look up. would probably mean something interesting.
Could mean whistle and I'll come.
Yes, Max, drink.
That's also the name of my BDSM group.
I was wondering when we were going to make that joke.
I figured I'd get out of the way so you wouldn't have to sell your hand.
Whistle and we'll come all over you. Oh, man, this might even be two drinks.
Oh, God. Ugh. Mixing J&B with wine was not a good idea.
That was your idea, though. I only talked you into the J&B, not the wine.
I just like to drink wine. It's just on the side for me.
He whistled it, and then he gets this vision. Beach, some strange figure. And this might not make sense unless you've seen the movie Meshes of the Afternoon, but the ghost in this kind of reminds me in some ways of the, like, mirror-faced character in that. The shrouded mirror-faced person or whatever. The demon in this one is great. I love it. I guess there's another interesting comparison I think you can make as far as his empty bed as a, like, poetic visual in this movie, where what if we look at the grave as a bed? You know, he went to these other people's beds, took something from them, and he whistled it. God, the camera. You know what I think it is about the simplicity of the camera work, Max, is that in doing a lot of the staging in depth and having big objects they use to help close off and frame our main character, it does give you a weird sense of paranoia where it not only does the world feel kind of like off kilter because there's so many things aligned in depth and it looks kind of chiaroscuro and gothic, it also gives you the sense of something like creeping and like watching him. It feels like he's pinned down.
And he's never quite in center of any of the frames that he's in.
No, often he's not. Yeah.
It's I would say like 90% of the time he's either to the left or the right of the center.
Yeah.
So you're always feeling like something should be coming from the other side of the frame.
Yes, he's always blocked off by something else. With these conversations,
he's always
scenes,
in a corner for the most part when he's inside. Like he's always just like, no, you can't get out. And
yeah.
It's very unsettling cinematography, and I do appreciate
and
that.
And it's so simple. You know, that's the real impressive thing about this to me is like there really is no substitute for just being like very good at the fundamentals, which clearly everyone who made this movie was. And I don't know much about what this director, I think his name is Jonathan Miller. Hold on, let me look this up on Letterboxd real quick. I don't know much else about what he did. Yes, his name is Jonathan Miller, director and producer. And but I do know that he made a number of things for the BBC around this time, including a 1966 adaptation of Alice in Wonderland that people hold in pretty high esteem.
Oh,
have you seen this?
Yes. There was a time that I was very, very into Alice in Wonderland. Like I bought a very shiny edition of Alice's Adventures Underground.
This is the poster.
Yes.
Okay, you've seen this. That's awesome. Do you remember it very well? Or
yeah, I really liked it. I do think it's the best. Listen, as much as I hate Disney, I do hold the Disney version, the original one, and a special place in my heart.
Sure.
But as a movie, that one is fucking amazing. I love
it. The 66 one?
Yes.
So there you go. So this director has a bit of pedigree.
That makes, okay.
Yeah.
I appreciate this a little bit more now. But
do you
yeah.
feel like there's any continuity between that adaptation and this one?
No, that one's a little bit more surreal. Cinematography-wise, a little bit, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Because the movie, it's trying to make you uneasy the entire time. It's fucking Alice in Wonderland.
But and I would say there's something a little bit, this movie does very well at communicating a tone of uncanniness.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's that. It makes sense.
Like, I would be curious to see how that director handles, like, outright surreal settings and characters, because this one is never outright surreal, but it does maintain very well that, like, line in between uncanniness and surrealness.
You can just remind me of that. I think I'm going to reread that when I get home.
It's so funny.
No. Just, such. I own a very nice copy of Alice's Adventures Underground, which is the precursor, like, the original tales for Alice in Wonderland.
Was it also written by Lewis Carroll?
Yeah, no, it was like the original stories that he told
to the girl.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then it was refined later into Alice in Wonderland. But I own a very nice copy of that, so I think I'll reread that when I get home.
If you haven't read Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, it's the most British thing ever. But it's delightful. It's delightful.
Alice Adventures Underground is a little bit more unpolished, but I think it does have a little bit more charm to it.
Also, don't read any of Lewis Carroll's other books, because he didn't write other books. He wrote, like, math problems, and it's fucking irritating.
And he was a weirdo and probably a pedophile, so...
Yeah. Yeah, we'll leave that where it is.
Okay, J&B time.
Oh, yes, he's about to
grumble. Prime British grumbling.
Oh, God, the grumbling.
And the
he's very satisfied after that dumb fucking joke. Take that, Shakespeare. Ding. Ding.
That's something it feels like he would say at a dinner party that he was at with his wife and, like, get...
And then nudge his wife with his elbow and she, like, rolls her eyes and, like, tries to hide her head.
Yeah, but, like, the other guys at the dinner parties they used to go to laughed, but all of them are dead now because he's old and has nowhere to be anymore.
Decrepit fossil.
Charlie Chaplin.
The Colonel. And he's so close to making a real friend, but apparently he says no. He says, no, I'm not going to walk with you, Colonel. I'm going to walk...
Good old Alan.
Alan. Weirdly,
we both misread it as alien the first time we saw it.
We were so distracted by that, I think neither of us really noticed how beautiful this shot is.
Yeah.
So just pretty. I just love this. It's so simple. Their control of light and framing is just great. Have you ever seen a short movie that so thoroughly, like, establishes a character's, like, lonesomeness? He is so fucking alone in this.
A short film or just a movie in general?
I guess a short film.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I guess, but the thing about a movie in general is that if you have a longer runtime, you probably have to introduce more elements. Where if this was longer, I probably wouldn't like it as much because it doesn't need to be.
I was thinking, because Memento is not that long, and I was thinking of Memento, of just like...
During this? Or just in general?
Just in the screening, okay. Honestly.
Yeah.
And I'm just like... In Memento, he has the one guy, but, like, the dude's in a position where he's just completely gone. Like, he has nowhere he truly belongs with his condition.
Like, yeah.
I think that's the only movie by Christopher Nolan I really like. But what are you going to do?
Oh, he's grumbling again.
Why? What a fucking vom.
Yeah, I was like, we're not going to finish these. And now I'm looking at mine, and it's like, more than halfway done. Oh, God, movie. Please don't do this to me. Don't mix J&B with Monster Energy. That doesn't seem like a good idea to me. Although, to be fair, I don't think you should mix J&B with anything.
I do Jaeger bombs. Or I used to do Jaeger bombs all the time. So it's fun. I'm used to it.
What's a good movie we could do where we could get Max to do Jaeger bombs again?
What is a Jaeger bomb approved movie? Tweet at us. At Spectator Film Podcast.
It's a movie about maybe The Master. The Master.
Super Size Me. Just how disgusting food destroys your body.
Oh, God. I don't even want to think about that.
I love how his physical acting is so great.
Yeah, because there's so many scenes where he's just, like, fidgeting.
He's fidgeting. He, like, props himself up. He's, like, it's almost like he keeps expecting something to happen, but then it doesn't. So he's like, oh, okay, I guess I'll do this.
And he keeps pulling
so
books out.
Lonely, yeah.
Yeah, he's like, oh, I'm here to read. And it's like, no, you're just waiting for someone to come who's not going to come because you don't have the introspection required to engage with other people in a sincere way.
Or not even that. Or, like, the one person who did, like, suit him has passed away. And it's just... He has nowhere else to be now. He's a relic of the past that is desperately trying to still fit into the world.
I think you could say that. However, when I look into this and I feel like there's that class resonance, that to me reinforces that it's him and his behavior. I feel like this guy has always been alone. That's just me, though.
No, you can do whatever you want. Yet again, I've said my view is tainted by the
2000
10 version.
I mean, I understand why if you're going to try to make a feature length version of this, why you might bring
it's
in the wife.
It's not that much longer.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's like, why though? You don't have to make it with a feature
length
mindset.
It's like 51 minutes. Like, it's not even an hour long.
That's not feature length, people.
I think it was part of a series of them trying to do like bring back shorts that they had done before, but
I guess none of them took.
Not really.
That's sad.
To be fair, the BBC is very hit or miss. Like,
that's okay though. You know,
I just wish they didn't. I'll watch the Great British Bake Off until the cows come home.
You know what you got to go watch? I don't know if you can find this. I saw it on Shudder multiple years ago. You got to go find the Steve Coogan series. Where every episode he lampoons a different type of horror movie. I think the first one is like lesbian vampire movies. And it's just him cracking a bunch of jokes every episode. And I think it's called like Dr. Horror's House of Terror.
Dr. Horrible sing-along blog.
Or no, it's called Dr. Terror's House of Horrible.
Okay.
Oh, that's a beautiful shot, by the way.
Yes.
I
was waiting. The one shot I never got in this movie was just footprints appearing behind him on the beach.
Ooh, that would have been creepy.
Yeah.
Max, do you believe in ghosts?
No.
Neither do I. I wish I did, but...
Nope. I have friends who do. I remember... I just remember a quote, and I think it popped on Facebook memories recently, of just like... me bashing my friend on Facebook of just like him just going like, no, Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, that's all bullshit. But ghosts are 100% real.
Ghosts are real. I would love to work on one of those ghost TV shows, like the Ghost Paranormal.
Dude, that's the most low effort, high paycheck entertainment job you can ever fucking get.
Really? You think so? I don't think they get huge paychecks, but it would be fun.
If you're one of like, not if you're like a grip or like a camera operator on that, but like,
but that would be fun.
If you're one of like the four personality people they have on there, holy shit, that's so easy.
I would love to be the medium person to bring in. And it's like, you just put on like John Lennon sunglasses.
I'm getting a J, a K, a.
I'm getting vibes, guys.
An L, an O,
another
L.
Max, it's the ghost.
It's a spoopy ghost.
Now, I do not know for sure how they did the ghost effect, but it looks very weird to me. It looks like unlike a lot of other things I've seen. I don't know if they had it on wires or what they did.
That's what it looks like to me, is they have they have fabric or plastic or something attached to a very small wire frame and let it blow in the wind.
Yeah, but something about the frame is like hard to it's hard to tell what the frame is still.
Well, I think they... Not to get like, I think they had a weight at the bottom. It's still moving across the sand, which is a great effect.
Yeah.
But it's not moving too much. Like, it flies into the ocean instantly. So they obviously have a weight at the bottom, and I think it's a small wire frame coming up from that. Just like possibly two things, and you put a fucking torn tarp over it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It does look interesting. I don't think I've seen a lot of things like it. It's very simple because they did not have a lot of money. But with that simplicity, it works with the rest of the simplicity of this movie. And it just kind of looks beautiful and interesting. Like, I really have not seen a lot like it. And they really disguise whatever frame they were using. It's hard to tell, like, what shape it is definitively. It just kind of looks like it's flowing. Speaking of which, I also believe there's a graphic novel adaptation of many of M.R. James's ghost stories. That I found while doing research for this movie.
And, dog.
Oh my God, a dog. I would love to go to a hotel and the hotel has like a dog.
I went to it wasn't a hotel, but I stayed at an Airbnb once.
And had a dog?
Yeah, they were just like, just so you know, we have a dog. He is too big and occasionally will barge into the area you're staying in.
Grumbling.
Oh, God. But no, he was a big, dumb, friendly greyhound, and I loved him so much. He was gigantic, and just like, they couldn't keep him out of rooms, but he just wanted pets. That's all he wanted. And I was like, okay, you're a good boy. I love you so much.
Yeah, I would love to have a dog. Listeners, if you can send me a dog or send me the coordinates of a dog that I can find, that would be great.
Yeah, Yeah, Austin's experiencing the loneliness of being separated from your family's pets and moving into an apartment.
Also, my family dog died right at the start of me moving in. I did tell you about this. Yes. Coco was 15 years old, so she lived a long, happy life.
You but did not tell me that.
I did tell you this. She passed away right as I moved in. And I don't blame you for not remembering because it's not happy to think about, but she passed away. And RIP to Coco.
Rest in peace, Coco. I loved Coco.
Yeah.
Even though Coco desperately did not want me to pet her, I tried my best.
She was very timid. She was like, don't touch me unless I can see what you're doing.
She did get used to me toward the end of the time that we were spending at your house. She did let me pet her.
Yeah. If you wanted to pet Coco, you had to like show her your hand, do it slowly. She had epilepsy, so she was a little bit like...
Yo, same.
Yeah.
She had, fun fact for all our listeners, I have epilepsy. It fucking sucks. Whenever I mention that, like, I study film and I have epilepsy, people are, like, give me the look, like, how do you do that? And I'm just like...
I don't think it's like...
Not everybody who has epilepsy has the flashy flash kind of epilepsy. Just,
sure.
Just to let all of our listeners know.
And thank God for that, because what a nightmare.
Yeah.
I don't think there would be a way to live. And like, you'd have to wear glasses, and depending on where you live. Can you imagine living somewhere near Times Square?
Well, like, I do know people with photosensitive epilepsy, and it does fucking suck for them.
Yeah, God. Oh, he's going to grumble a lot in this scene. Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, look, he said Shmi. He's reading Peter Pan.
Luckily, but like kind of epilepsy I have is just like brought on by exhaustion and lack of sleep. So need to make sure.
So just at risk, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm on a shit ton of meds for it, though. So.
Well, there you go.
I can live in a normal life, relatively. I can still drive and whatnot.
And drink. Which you have to do now. This entire scene is grumbling. I'm supposed to go on a date after this. How am I going to do this? This was a terrible idea.
I'll be your date, Austin.
That's not going to work. Oh my God. So he's starting to have doubts and he's just doing his... What is he doing the entire fucking day? Just nothing? I kind of believe that. He's just so lonely.
I believe... that's what I interpreted it as just like... As the ghost haunting, like the few people he was interacting with or observed in the hotel just disappeared. And he's like, he's just getting more and more removed from everybody. If we're taking this movie as...
Yeah.
A metaphor for just like... loneliness and almost dementia in your old age, like that works perfectly.
Yeah. And this scene, I think this little bit is important when he's eating food there, because then he makes a comment about the tomatoes that reminds me a lot of my boomer dad, where listeners, I often would not go out to eat with my dad because it makes me uncomfortable the way he treats people who serve food, right? So if there was a mistake in the dish or something, it's like the type of boomer comment, and this is definitely a boomer thing. Many listeners will relate to this, where it's like a shortness with the staff at this restaurant who are exhausted and have a very challenging job.
Oh, my God.
And blaming them for, like, having tomatoes, which is what this guy says. He says, I told them I didn't like tomatoes, blah, blah, blah.
The story that my sister and I still use to make sure our mom behaves herself in public. So my mom... I want to go on record here. My mom has been wonderful to me. She is a sweetheart.
But
she also grew up in an all white town in New Hampshire.
Okay.
And is a boomer. So occasionally she'll slip and it's up to my sister and I to be like, what can I say but yikes?
Yes.
So we have this very vivid memory of us going to a hibachi restaurant.
Oh no.
When we were younger. It was like a birthday present for me when I was like prime weeb territory. And my grandparents that were there and everything had finished up. Like we had finished eating, we had finished dessert.
Finish the story soon because this ghost is coming.
But we we're hanging around there for a long, long time just talking. And the waiter came up to us like, oh, we have another reservation. We would, if you could get going soon, we would really appreciate that. Mom goes, well, in our culture, that's very rude to say. And the terror on my sister's and I's face were fucking palpable. And we were just mouthing, I'm so sorry to the waiters the entire time we were leaving.
Without you or your sister, your mom would become this man. She would go to a place by herself and then be haunted by a ghost because she took a whistle.
I love you, Mom. I've known you. I know you've grown since then, but still, fucking yikes, man.
Well, here's the thing is that I think that final moment where he complains about tomatoes and the fact of that happening right before we see the ghost at the end, significant, because it's like this is who this person is. They have surrendered to that like class-based interaction where they treat other people as a means to get the commodity that they desire from them. Other people are there to provide them commodities. They're not people. And here we have the sheep monster.
Ooh.
Which we barely show, but it's very creepy. And you know what we did not talk about at all throughout this entire thing?
Well, because that's the first non-dream sequence supernatural shit that we see.
And he reverts to a child sucking his thumb. Yeah. I will say, though, in this moment, unbelievable acting. And I think specifically, unbelievable vocal acting. The sounds that this actor makes when he first sees the ghost are incredible. Because they feel so authentic in a way I cannot describe, really. It just hits me. It's like, that is the sound of this old man seeing a ghost. And the movie's just going to end. Nothing really bad happens to him. He's just had his entire worldview destroyed and is potentially driven insane. So I guess that's a bad thing that happened to him. But I'm saying he didn't get stabbed or anything. It's just, as far as we know, he's just, you know, frightened and shaken up a little.
I took it as him, like, completely, like, he's lost his marbles at this point. Like, yeah. this is his end as, like, an individual person.
Yeah.
And now he's going to be, like, committed somewhere.
That could be the moment of his demise, mentally. Yeah, and the colonel just comes in and, like, we have to wonder, did the colonel see it or what did he do? I mean, because he just treats it like...
I think the colonel was, like, the one who was, like, genuinely trying to connect with this guy but realized he was, like, about to be gone.
Yes, the colonel treats him like he expects him to be gone because he just goes into the bed and he says, okay, we're folding the bed because this guy is losing it a little bit. He's an old timer, right? So, yeah, I mean, it's a very depressing ending.
Oh,
I
no. Think.
Yeah.
Well, it's British.
But I guess the point I just want to make about this is that you can view this is a very like moody thing to watch with your friends for Halloween, but like it's still like a fun, good ghost story. Speaking of which, that's why M.R. James wrote these stories. He worked at Cambridge and or Oxford, whatever the fuck. He was an Oxbridge scholar, and he wrote the story in 1904. And he wrote all these ghost stories to scare and fuck with his colleagues, which I think is kind of cute. I don't know. I just think you can view it as a fun atmospheric exercise in the ghost story genre, but I do not think you should overlook the class dimension of this because I do think this movie emphasizes that. And it says like this style of living, this style of interacting with other people as producers of commodities only is going to alienate you from other people and you will not live a happy life. And, you're going to be separated from everyone else when your darkest moment comes. So I don't know. I just think it's a great movie. It's just 40 minutes and it's just a blast.
As a short film, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And if you want to scare and fuck with your colleagues, you can show them the Spectator Film Podcast.
Doubly horrified.
Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and more.
This JMB is hitting me now.
Yes, we're going to pass out immediately from drinking too much JMB from our own self-imposed drinking game.
God.
But yeah, be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Tumblr, Twitter, and all other social medias. Be sure to share us with anybody you like. And
we don't
likes
have a
film.
Facebook.
Sure we do.
No, we don't.
I'll make it right now. But But yeah, just follow us on social media, share us with other people, and let us know on Instagram or Twitter what kind of movies you would want us to
We have a Letterboxd.
Yes.
We have a Letterboxd in www.spectatorfilmpodcast.com. And keep interacting with us and rate our show.
We promise we're not the most of a train wreck every single time. We love you guys. Bye.